Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The bloodshed in Egypt continues. Today's guest, Nancy Youssef, reports that abandoned highways and bridges were peppered with burnt cars, blockades, and army tanks as Mohamed Morsi supporters marched in what they called a day of rage against Wednesday's unprecedented government crackdown, which killed at least 638 people and injured thousands. She reports that the various protests could never gain momentum as they were always confronted by repeated gunfire, forcing them to disperse. By day's end, Cairo appeared to be entering a vicious cycle of violence. Lines of dead bodies were at mosques, turned into makeshift morgues, and each side blamed the other for the violence. Joining us to talk about the latest bloodshed is Nancy Youssef, McClatchy Newspaper's Middle East correspondent, and she joins us from Cairo. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. And on Monday, federal judge Shira Scheindlin ruled that New York City has routinely and systematically violated the Constitution by unlawfully stopping and frisking young men of color. The NYPD stopped more than 684,000 people in 2011. This is a 600% increase from Bloomberg's first year in office in 2002. 90% of those stopped Black and Latino. This is receiving widespread coverage, but what does the ruling mean exactly? An end to stop and frisk? A major change? Kristen Gwynn asks those questions in her piece about the ruling. It's called An End to NYPD's Racist Stop and Frisk, What You Need to Know About the Landmark Ruling. Kristen is an associate editor and drug policy reporter with Alternet. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And in another major story this week, Attorney General Eric Holder was in San Francisco on Monday giving a talk at the American Bar Association. He said the so-called war on drugs has needlessly imprisoned thousands of Americans for minor crimes. He noted that the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners. He said policy changes could reduce or possibly eliminate federal sentences for low-level drug offenders. But what policy changes exactly is he talking about? The media treated this announcement as a major game changer, but is it? Bob Agelko covered the speech for the San Francisco Chronicle, where he is a staff writer. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Bob, let's start with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'll tell you, I have to pay tribute to my colleagues in Egypt. You know, the death toll included, from what I understand, at least four journalists, and I've been hearing and watching these brave people who, you know, have to deal not only with deadlines and editors, but with gunfire, danger, uncertainty. You know, watching Richard Engel on NBC and Sharif Abdul-Qaddous on Democracy Now, and hearing people talk about the gunfire they endured, and then just reading some of the copy. David Kirkpatrick in yesterday's New York Times went away from the sort of standard fare, you know, violent clashes on the one hand, on the other hand, and really kind of told it like it was, as far as I could see. The lead talked about the scorched earth assault, killed hundreds, violent backlash, underscored the new government's determination to crush the Islamists, and didn't take at face value what authorities were telling him about, you know, equal violence on the other side and terrorists and caches of weapons. So I guess a salute and my hats off to the brave people who are telling us what we need to know from a very dangerous part of the world.
Mm. Yeah, and we the committee to protect journalists also has information about at least 78 assaults on journalists in Egypt from August 2012. And just on Wednesday, at least a dozen journalists were detained, injured, or threatened. And we've seen such incredible reporting from journalists who are just in the thick of the bloodshed. And we'll go to Cairo to talk about this in just a couple minutes with McClatchy's Nancy Youssef. What about you, Kristen? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Sheila Baffett at RH Reality Tech has a piece called Background Tech Errors Make It Harder for Women, People of Color to Get and Keep Jobs. And I thought this was a really important article because she brings up a part of the Patriot Act that a lot of people are unaware of, which is increased background checks on workers, particularly people of color, and many of them, half of them actually, include faulty information, and we know that employers tend to be prejudiced against people who have a criminal record, particularly if they have a felony, but also even if they've been just arrested, a lot of that information is still available and used against people who haven't been convicted of crimes. And in communities where people are overly policed, and or aggressively policed at least, and subject to more police intervention, the effects that it can have on employment and just economic stability in general are a severe problem that we need to think about more.
And are we talking about a wide range of jobs here?
Yeah, a lot of jobs. In her article, she says that at least 600,000 workers may be prejudiced in their job search. And that's just an estimate of how many are actually working, deciding against them because of it. But it's increased sixfold since 2002. And the exact number, I'm not sure.
That's okay. We'll find the story and we'll link to it after the show. It sounds like it would be actually a good topic for a show. So thank you for that, Kristen. And let's go to Cairo. Nancy, what about you? I mean, I know you're in just the middle of this violence in Cairo. What kind of reporting are you seeing on the ground in Egypt?
Well, it's become really important reporting because everybody has an idea in terms of what they tell you. So you have to see it for yourself. And so a lot of journalists are having to put themselves in the thick of things just to get a sense of what's happening in a way that we didn't even a few weeks ago because everybody has such widely different versions of events. And so you not only have to ask for the military, opponents in the military, but then try to find objective people who saw what happened if you didn't, and try to understand what happened. And so on top of that, it's also been just very gruesome. I mean, you know, we talk about the number 600, and it's easy to sort of gloss over that, but when you have to see hundreds of bodies, it's really something that, I mean, I haven't seen this scale of violence since my time in reporting in Iraq, and that was, you know, 6 years ago or 5 years ago that I was last doing that. I mean, it's really shaking the country, and I think it's shaking the journalists who just weren't prepared to see this level of violence. I mean, it's gone from 0 to 60 in a way we hadn't really anticipated.
It's shocking that so many people have been killed, Nancy, over 600, thousands wounded. Why have so many people been killed? I mean, this morning there were photos of people jumping off of the bridge because they were being shot at.
Yeah, well, on the 600 that were killed on Wednesday, the reason so many is because what I don't think people understand is Rabaa, the major city, was really a city unto itself. It had its own generators, its own kitchens, its own bathrooms, its own housing. The tents were numbered, and there were literally thousands of people there. And so to clear something as rapidly as the security forces did, there was going to involve a lot of deaths, and I think that's why a lot of us didn't think it would happen that way. I mean, it was unavoidable in the sense that if your objective was to clear that site, imagine trying to clear a city, or a small city, in a matter of hours, it was going to be violent. And so that's why we have the 600. Today, from what I saw, I mean, I was out in the fighting for about 3 hours, and from what I saw, it's just rapid gunfire, and you don't know where it's coming from. You don't know if it's from the residents, if it's from the Morsi supporters, or from the military. And I think some people are jumping because you're literally watching people fall around you, and everybody's armed now with something, whether it be a machete or a stick or a gun.
Wow. Can you just walk us through, like today, what did you face today, and how do you go about reporting something like this when you're in the middle of gunfire?
Well, we started by going to the funeral for Asma al-Baltaghi, who's the daughter of Muhammad al-Baltaghi, who's the top Brotherhood leader. And then the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party, and there we sort of knew that things were going to, it was sort of ominous, and that women, obviously, you know, over the women's section, they were writing their names on their forearms in case they themselves ended up in the morgue. And so it was so sort of fatalistic, we knew. And then the marches started out going towards the burial site, and from there we started hearing reports of various protests going on, and And we went and basically ran and ducked and ran and ducked. And every time we could, we'd interview somebody, whether it be a supporter of Morsu or a police officer or a resident. And in between all that sort of running and ducking, you're seeing people armed. And as you're driving through the streets, you're seeing these checkpoints and seeing these burnt cars and seeing the tanks posted everywhere. And so you sort of thread all that together to put the story together. And we're back home now because here in Cairo, it's 7 p.m. and we're under curfew. And the military said that they would come down very heavy-handedly on those who defy the curfew. That was pretty much our day.
And that is Nancy Youssef. She is a Middle East correspondent for McClatchy. She's joining us from Cairo. And Nancy will be on with us for about another 10 minutes. So if you have any questions for her about what is happening on the ground, be sure to also read her piece, After Friday Prayers, Bloodshed Breaks Out in Egypt. It's on our website. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. We're also joined by Kristen Gwynn, associate editor at Alternet, and Bob Agelko. He's a staff writer with The Chronicle. Nancy, how are the people reacting to these mass killings? What are you hearing from people on the streets?
Well, it's a great question because, you know, on one hand, there were people who were really frustrated with the Brotherhood and the fact that they'd stayed just sit in, which had logistically blocked traffic. And also for a lot of them, it was seen as a nuisance and a minority view when the majority really wanted to, the military back in control, or certainly the Brotherhood not in control anymore. But now I think there's a sort of mix of shock and frustration. And the most prevailing thing I hear is that site had to be cleared, and yet what happened is horrific. And it's funny, this is a city of 20 million, and it feels like it's abandoned because so many people are inside hiding. And there's just this feeling of shock, this like patina of shock that's sort of hanging over the city because it's not functioning normally. It hasn't been sensing in any real way. And also, frankly, fear that we've entered a cycle of violence and that this will continue for some time.
What about opinion of the military? Are people angry at what the military is doing?
It's starting to shift after what's happened, but I do think the majority still supports the military. They see them as a sort of last protectors of the state, if you will, and they see the Brotherhood as people who are willing to obstruct the progress of the nation. Remember that the Brotherhood to win just has to not lose, or the military has to win. So the bar is much higher for the military. But I think where people are sort of overwhelmingly supporting the military, that's subsided because, again, just the scale of the violence is a lot. But, again, you can find people who say, I'm glad the military did it. They had to do it. We had to get rid of the Brotherhood.
Wow.
And there are those who are really shocked by the level of violence and fear that all it's doing is perpetuating more violence.
So after all of this bloodshed, there people are still supporting the military. Does that surprise you?
Yeah, absolutely. Remember that the military really is the most revered institution here, and that we don't really have an alternative in the sense that there's the two biggest institutions are the military and the Brotherhood, and there's so much anger about how the Brotherhood led Egypt and the feeling that they sort of started this divisiveness, that of the two, that the military is the lesser of the two evils, and essentially they trust them more to look out for the institutions of the state. Now, the counter-argument is that rather than sort of laying the groundwork for political activity in Egypt, they're actually sort of formulating what political life will look like in Egypt in the way that they want. So we'll see that support holds as much as it does now. But remember that they're being looked at not only as Egypt's most revered institution, but as the best alternative between these two very different camps in terms of how to lead Egypt.
Bob Agelko, do you have any questions for Nancy Youssef in Cairo?
We saw the comments by President Obama yesterday canceling this joint military exercise, but very pointedly not saying anything about the $1.3 billion annual military aid that the United States provides. And I was just wondering what impact that might have, whether there's any views among the populace that Nancy contacts about the United States, or you know, what difference our policy might make?
Well, it's a great question, because on one hand, that military aid is essential to the Egyptian military, and those exercises are essential. On the other hand, that aid is also very helpful to the United States. $800 million of it actually goes towards defense jobs and contracts to build equipment that has been sent to the military, and that's how the Egyptians see it. It's something that helps the United States as much as it helps Egypt. I think one of the reasons that people are sort of not realizing the impact of the aid is that Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the UAE pledged $12 billion, and essentially much of it a blank check, to the Egyptian government after Morsi's fall. And so there's a feeling that that will sort of carry the nation far more than the $1.3 billion did, which had a lot of conditions on it. I was talking to a top Brotherhood leader just before we went on the air, and I was asking him, what role can the U.S. play? And he said, it's beyond any American. It's beyond any ambassador. It's beyond any diplomat. It's beyond any president. That this is something we have to sort out ourselves. Hmm. And I think that realization is starting to set in, particularly as you see the violence happening. But the diplomatic efforts in the past 2 weeks failed to stop this, because they couldn't agree on even basic things, let alone key things like Morsi's future and the future of the Muslim Brotherhood and the political process going forward.
And Kristen, do you have any questions for Nancy?
I'm curious about the reports of high instance of rape and what she thinks needs to be done to protect women in the revolution.
That's another great question. It is a huge problem here. I can tell you that I don't go to Tahrir anymore. Tahrir Square, the sort of iconic place where this all started in 2011. Sexual assault has always been a part of Egypt, but up until all this, it wasn't nearly as pervasive or open or as common. It usually happened after soccer matches and things. One of the reasons is the Egyptian government never really prosecuted those for doing it. There's a culture here that sort of allows for women to be sexually assaulted, or at least not punish men who do it. And there's also, frankly, a level of sexual frustration in this country that I don't think we fully understand in the West, in that a lot of men here are virgins until in their 30s, because you can't get married or enter you can't get married until you can provide for a woman, and most of them can't do it until their 30s. So all of that, plus the sort of increased sexualization of our world and the fact that the sort of social norms have collapsed since 2011, have really all led to this really pervasive problem. And I can tell you that it is very rare for me to step outside the house without someone saying something or trying to grab me or something along those lines.
Mm.
And it's devastating.
What is the state, Nancy, of the organizations that are trying to help women who have to deal with this?
You know, it's been really impressive to see how much Egyptians, particularly young Egyptians, are stepping up and saying, we're not going to tolerate this. And they've really done it at great cost to themselves. And you'll see people wearing vests and stuff in an effort to try to protect women. The challenge they face is that I don't go because it can't be just that you go with one man to protect you, because we're talking about scores of men surrounding one woman. And it's become so organized in Tahrir that you'll find that they'll literally find jobs. Somebody's assigned to ripping off the shirt. Somebody's assigned to ripping off pants. So not one person can protect you. And that's the challenge they face. They can sort of do a lot to sort of send a message. But until you have a government that really treats this as a serious issue, there are limitations of what they can do. Now, that all said, those sort of assaults were really prevalent. I can tell you more so among the Tahrir Square crowd, which were the more liberals, those who oppose Morsi. When I go to the Morsi sit-ins, or when I did when I was there, or today, I don't feel that kind of sexual assault pressure from the Islamists. I have to tell you, it happens more often with the liberals. And so that's something we haven't experienced in the last few days, because those who are out primarily are Islamists.
Well, we have a question for you, Nancy, from John. So let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. It seems very clearly that the military is responsible for the violence But I'd like to know, just from a reporter's standpoint, looking at it as objectively as possible, what kind of an argument can the military make for conducting this violence?
Well, John, it's a great point. And the argument that the military makes is that we have the will of the people behind us. That last month, when General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the Minister of Defense, and the man who announced Morsi's ouster, asked people to go to the streets and give him the mandate to deal with the problem of the Brotherhood, they did. And that, therefore, they are carrying out the will of the people. The other thing I would say is, and it's hard for us to understand it in the Western world, I think, is, you know, the military sees itself as such a revered institution that I think they really believe that they know what's in Egypt's best interest and that they can sort of address this problem of the Islamists, and that they will have the public backing, that if they crack down on the Islamists, they can still carry the support of the public because they're held in such high esteem by the Egyptian populace. So those are the two things that they're sort of using to their advantage, if you will, or to make their case, that
and
the public gave them the mandate. They have a high place in Egypt in the hearts and minds of their fellow Egyptians.
Have you been able to interview anyone in the military?
Yeah, early on we spoke to Colonel Ahmed Muhammad Ali, who's a spokesman who saw early on. And just today we've spoken to officers out in the street to tell us, you know, for example, they shot on protesters because they were trying to attack a church, and then you ask the protesters and they say, we weren't attacking a church, we were just walking by it. So you can talk to people all the time, and we have friends who are in the military and tell us a little bit about how they're being told that the Brotherhood is terrorizing the country and all this. So yeah, we don't get to talk to generals or anything like of those lines, or current generals, because it's such an opaque organization. But day to day we get to talk to sort of rank and file and mid-level guys who give us some sense about what's going on within the military.
And Nancy, we have about a minute before a break. The police and security forces are targeting journalists. At least a dozen journalists have been detained, injured, or threatened. What is the status of local journalism in Cairo?
Well, I would tell you that they're probably being targeted more or as much as foreign journalists. I mean, and there are a lot of really brave ones here who are really exploring journalism for the first time. I mean, the problem you run into, and one that I'm lucky that I don't have, and when you're carrying a camera, you're sort of clearly a journalist. We spoke to a soldier the other day who told us that he was told to go after Al Jazeera journalists because they were seen as Morsi supporters. So they're just as susceptible, if not more so, than we are, to the sort of the whims of the ruling military sided government. And I think a lot of them are quite courageous, and we depend on them to help us understand what's happening here. So we talk a lot about Western journalists, but I think that the danger is just as much so for those who are here, who are new to journalism and really trying to report what's happening in our country.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your excellent reporting.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Great to be
Thank you. That is Nancy Youssef joining us from Cairo, where it's just about 7:30 at night. She is a Middle East correspondent from McClatchy, and you can find her piece, After Friday Prayers, Bloodshed Breaks Out in Egypt, on our website. And after the break, we will talk about the NYPD's stop and frisk policy and the judge's ruling. And we'll also talk about Attorney General Eric Holder's announcement on the so-called war on drugs. We'll be back after this.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. We invite you right now to highlight the reporting that you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the most effective tactic for abortion rights supporters. The Abortion Rights Freedom Ride is currently underway. A group of activists are traveling to battleground states with very few clinics, and their message is abortion on demand and without apology. But groups like Planned Parenthood and NARAL do not use that language. So what are your thoughts on the best way to protect this constitutional right? What should the message and the tactics be? That's the conversation on Monday. And then on Tuesday, we will talk about how the energy market in California is regulated. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission recently issued a notice of alleged violations against JP Morgan Chase for violating the energy market for 10 months in 2010 and 2011. The settlement could be close to $500 million. So we'll ask, what's really changed since Enron? Remember that? And how is the energy market regulated in California? That's Tuesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're joined by Kristen Gwynn. She has been covering the NYPD's stop and frisk policy. A judge recently ruled that it's unconstitutional. Kristen is an associate editor and drug policy reporter at Alternet. And then on Monday, Attorney General Eric Holder was in San Francisco giving a talk at the American Bar Association, saying the so-called war on drugs has needlessly imprisoned thousands of Americans for relatively minor crimes. So will we see major changes because of this speech? Bob Agelko covered it for the San Francisco Chronicle, where he's a staff writer. And we'd love to hear from you. What really stood out for you in the media this week? Was there a story that you saw that you think deserves more attention? What did you think about the NYPD announcement and Eric Holder's announcement? Both of these stories got a lot of coverage, even international coverage. So what really stood out for you? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So let's talk about the stop and frisk policy. Kristen, you've been covering this, and U.S. District Judge Shira Scheindlin had some pretty tough words on this. She called it, quote, indirect racial profiling. She actually footnoted Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. First of all, talk about the significance of the ruling itself and the language that the judge used.
The judge's opinion was definitely, I think I've heard it described as maybe even scathing. She's been dealing with stop and frisk and the NYPD's racial profiling for a long time now. And so she's, at this point, I think, just fed up with their just lack of any kind of openness to changing or even acknowledging that there are problems. And so she was very clear in her decision that this is a policy being directed from the top, that Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Kelly are responsible for hundreds of thousands, at least, unconstitutional stops directed at young Black and Latino men who are oftentimes just trying to go to school or to work or home and feel that they are kind of imprisoned in their own houses because they can't leave without being touched by the police. And she also was clear in saying that this is a problem that goes beyond something that people may consider to be a mild distraction. I forget her exact wording, but she was clear in saying that this is a traumatic experience for the people who deal with it on a regular basis in many communities, and that having your rights being violated like that should not be a rite of passage, and that this is a disturbance to people's lives, and we need to stop it now to just give them a better quality of life and even opportunity, because though the majority of these stops don't end in arrest, they do condition young teenagers and kids to be involved with the police and arrested for not having IDs and things like that. And so it's just an introduction to the criminal justice system for a lot of these kids in these communities.
You report the NYPD stopped more than 684,000 people in 2011. 90% of those stopped have been Black or Latino. The judge ordered a number of remedies, including a pilot program in which officers in at least five precincts across the city will wear body-worn cameras to record street encounters. She also ordered a joint remedial process, so basically a series of community meetings to get public input on how to reform this. But you ask a very important question in your piece, and that is an end to NYPD's stop and frisk. What will actually change here?
Well, I think a lot of that will depend on who the new mayor is and how much he or she is invested in changing this, because it's going to be a process. We're going to have to change the way that the NYPD is operating. Stop and frisk is a huge part of their crime reduction strategy. And it's not an end to stop and frisk, for sure. It's kind of a basic policing tactic in a lot of urban places. And if used correctly, it's supposed to just give police the ability to stop someone who is in the middle or had just committed a crime. And the only way you can do that is if you have reasonable suspicion or you feel that your life is in danger, basically. And so what she's really just trying to do is force police to follow the law and find reasonable suspicion have some kind of accountability process by which to make sure that is happening. But the problem is that the NYPD has to cooperate for this to work. And so we need someone who, we need a new mayor and a new commissioner who will really be hard on their police officers and train them and make sure they know the law and that they understand the importance of following it.
And Bob, you cover these issues. I mean, there are stop and frisk policies across the country, but the NYPD's is massive. And a lot of lawyers say that this is actually a significant ruling because whatever happens in New York could really spread across the country. How significant do you think this ruling is?
Well, Chip Johnson, in a column in our paper, pointed out today it certainly has some local implications, because you'll remember that William Bratton, the former police chief in New York in the mid-90s and later police chief in Los Angeles, is now a consultant to the very troubled Oakland Police Department, and came in as a strong proponent of stop and frisk. And, well, you know, as we just heard, stop and frisk is a standard constitutional police tactic if you have a reasonable suspicion. What New York was doing was making it the staple of its enforcement, particularly in what they call high crime neighborhoods. They'd stop and frisk anybody of color, and regardless of the fact that they didn't find any weapons or anything else. And Mr. Bratton was a proponent of that here, but the Oakland authorities, city council, and the mayor made it quite clear that they were not going to implement a policy based on that. And the column by Chip Johnson pointed out today, the ruling by Judge Shineland seems to vindicate it. Not that you can't use stop and frisk based on reasonable suspicion, but you can't just tell police to go out in high crime neighborhoods and stop and frisk anybody who dresses and looks a certain way and maybe implicitly has a certain skin color. And this is a kind of a pushback, maybe by the judiciary and perhaps by the community as well, and we'll see what effect it has. I guess it also ought to be pointed out that Mr. Kelly, the New York Police Commissioner, has been reported to be under consideration by President Obama to be the new Homeland Security Secretary, and perhaps this ruling will affect his chances to do it. Of course, there are higher courts, and Mayor Bloomberg has said that he'll appeal this to the Second Circuit and seek a stay, and we'll see how that all turns out. But I do think it's a very important statement by a judge who heard the evidence, who heard witnesses who'd been subjected to it, saw the statistics, saw the results, that is, the lack of criminal evidence that was really uncovered by it all, and reached the conclusion that not only did it violate the Fourth Amendment as unreasonable searches and seizures, but it, as you said, amounted to indirect racial profiling and violated the right to be free of discrimination.
And Bob, how do you go about covering something like this? Because it was a 195-page ruling. This is a massive ruling. Again, the judge quoted everything from New York Times op-eds to President Obama's speech following George Zimmerman's acquittal to Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. And, you know, some stories quoted young men who have been stopped after the George Zimmerman trial. We're hearing, at least I'm hearing, so many young men talk about how they've been stopped for, you know, merely shopping or walking down the street. So how do you report on such a massive ruling?
I guess my experience is, and I've not read Judge Shannon's ruling, just the coverage of it, my experience is that to really put it in context, you have to cover the trial. You know, we've had lengthy trials here, whether it's Prop 8 or, you know, Barry Bonds or whatever, where the outcome, you know, makes sense if you read and go in and deeply go into the judge's ruling, but it makes much more sense if you have the human story that's been the result of weeks of testimony, and in this case, by people who were directly affected by the policies in question. That's the context, and that's what gives these words a human dimension.
What are your thoughts, Kristen? Your piece is pretty long. I mean, you focus on a number of different aspects of this. How do you make this palatable to people who might not know exactly what's happening with Stop and Frisk?
I always do try to put a human face on the issue and use the voices and people who have been affected to explain, you know, why it is such an important issue and to give people an idea of what it feels like to be stop and frisk. And for this ruling, I did cover the trial and was there for the majority of it every day in the courtroom. And I've been covering stop and frisk for years. So I've been in the neighborhoods that are the most affected by, you know, Brownsville, Brooklyn, East Harlem, interviewing teenagers about it for years. And so I really do try to let their voices be a big part of it so that people can understand that nobody wants these neighborhoods to be safer than the people who live there. And the people who are affected by Stop and Frisk need to have a stake in what is happening and how they are policed in their own community.
Were there many other reporters in the courtroom?
Usually, yes. Some days, depending on who was testifying, it would either be completely full or there would be, you know, 5 to 10 of us tops.
And that is Kristen Gwynn. She covers stop and frisk policies. You can find her latest piece on our website. She's associate editor and drug policy reporter at Alternet. And Bob Agelko is a staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, and he covered Attorney General Eric Holder's speech on Monday. He gave a talk at the American Bar Association saying the so-called war on drugs has needlessly imprisoned thousands of Americans for minor crimes. And if you'd like to weigh in on these issues, they got a lot of attention, even international attention this week. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Where did you see good context? And then when we're talking about mandatory sentencing, where did this come from in the first place? What about the history of these sentences? And we have just over 10 minutes left. So if there's anything else you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from George in San Francisco, who wants to talk about Eric Holder's speech on Monday. Hi, George.
Hi. 2 points, actually. And one is directly related to the speech of the Attorney General when he says that people have been overcharged and sentencing guidelines should be changed. What impact is that going to have on the inmates who are sitting out these extra long sentences? How will they be compensated and released before the full extent of the term? Number one. Number two is, this isn't really unrelated to the stop and frisk, is it? After all, if you happen to be carrying some other kind of contraband other than a weapon, a so-called controlled substance could land you in trouble. And if there's a change in policy about guidelines related to so-called controlled substances, then the Attorney General is addressing stop and frisk.
All right. Well, thank you for that. What are your thoughts, Bob? Half of 200,000 people in federal prison are locked up because of drug offenses, according to the Sentencing Project, and 60% are serving time under mandatory sentencing. So will any of these proposed policies affect them?
Nope. There's nothing retroactive, at least as stated, there's nothing retroactive about Attorney General Holder's announcement. Henceforth, he says that for people who are charged with drug offenses, if you are not, as he put it, if you are a certain low-level, nonviolent drug offenders who have no ties to large-scale organizations, gangs, or cartels, you are not to be subjected to mandatory minimums, which means that you won't be charged with trafficking or transporting or possessing a certain quantity of drugs, which subjects you to a mandatory 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, but instead you will simply be charged with these drug violations, and the judge will decide, presumably within the federal guidelines, how long to sentence you if you're convicted. This will have no effect, at least the stated policy, on anybody now in prison. So the 219,000 people we now have, of whom nearly half are doing time for drug offenses, maybe 40% of those, upwards of 40,000 anyway, by the figures I've seen, are serving mandatory minimums. There's not one bit of relief for them in this new policy, unless it's, you know, somehow made retroactive, unless there's some lawsuits or something like that. There's nothing in what the AG said that will affect people in prison. Further, the policy has a lot of wiggle room. You know, what's a large-scale organization, gang or cartel? What does it take to have a connection to it? That call evidently is going to be made by the U.S. attorneys. There's 93 of them. And you know, they have an incentive to use mandatory minimums because it gives them leverage. You go to a mid-level or low-level defendant and say, if you don't roll over on Mr. Big, we're going to throw the book at you. Hmm. And that's how mandatory minimums come into play, because they said the judge, no matter what the judge thinks of what you did, is going to have to give you 10 years or whatever because of the amount you were carrying. And these U.S. attorneys do not have too much of an incentive to waive this or interpret this new policy rather broadly. You know, we'll obviously see how it plays out, but just as a cautionary note, California's experience with medical marijuana, with great fanfare, the administration announced when it came in it's going to respect state laws and not throw federal prosecutions at people who are abiding by them. Well, lo and behold, October 2011, the U.S. Attorney's offices in California announced that every dispensary, basically, in the state was this drug profiteer and was violating state law as far as they could see, and they're going to shut them down. And since then, hundreds have been closed down. The Department of Justice hasn't you know, raised a hand to object, so evidently this is consistent with their policy. These are the same U.S. attorneys who are going to be interpreting Attorney General Holder's new policy, and I guess before I pronounce this a game changer, it certainly was in terms of rhetoric, I'd like to see how it plays out on the ground.
Well, and when you're talking about the people who are in jail right now, 219,000, were you able to ask the Attorney General any questions when he spoke?
No, but the Department of Justice did issue a fact sheet, and it makes it pretty clear that this is prospective only.
Okay.
It's going to apply only to new prosecutions. If they have any intention of doing anything about the people who are already in prison, they are not saying so. Now, there is some congressional legislation with some bipartisan support to give judges some leeway on mandatory minimums and to lower some of the minimums, and it could be if some of that passes, there'll be grounds for some litigation by prisoners to say we should be allowed to take advantage of that, but it hasn't passed, and this is all in the future.
Kristen, when you look at the headlines, it sure sounds like we're going to see a massive policy shift. So NBC News, Holder, new approach to reduce mandatory drug sentences. The Associated Press, Eric Holder announces major shift in federal drug sentencing policies. I mean, if you're just looking at the headlines, which, frankly, a lot of people do these days, it sounds like there's going to be major changes. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's a lot of work that needs to be done on these vague kind of recommendations are definitely a step in the right direction, but the idea that there would be some kind of sweeping reform is unfortunately, I think, idealistic. And we've seen with the Obama administration already a kind of, I think it's been called a softer, gentler drug war, where the rhetoric is different and we see a little bit of changes, but the majority of of the money that involved in drug crimes is still going to incarceration, and we're still seeing racial disparities, and we're not seeing a vast increase in treatment. And hopefully we do, but I think it will take real change and some specifics for that to actually happen.
And Bob, Tim Dickinson of Rolling Stone writes, quote, "On the face of it, this sounds like a sweeping reform, but its actual impact on the problem of over-incarceration is likely to be minimal. The reality is that the federal government is only a mid-sized player in the country's world-leading incarceration game. There are more than 2 million people behind bars in this country. About 10% of those prisoners can be found in federal lockup. 89,000 are there for drug offenses. The policy change is unlikely to impact those charged with marijuana crimes. But even reflecting the past hysteria of the crack epidemic, 30,000 in for rock cocaine. In short," he writes, "we're talking about a policy change that might affect a few hundred, perhaps a few thousand prosecutions a year. Do you agree with that?"
By all outward indications, considering the people who are actually going to implement them, that sounds like a very plausible outcome. Again, we'll have to see how it plays out in reality. It could be that it'll be inconsistently around the country, depending on U.S. attorneys' offices and the like. But it's quite true, I think, that the federal government has only a fraction of the prisoners, even the prisoners subjected to mandatory minimum sentences. Let's not forget, we're in California, home of three strikes, the toughest, I guess you could say, mandatory minimum and certainly repeat offender policy in the country, and it's becoming, having more and more effect as the years go on. It was passed in 1994, softened some by ballot initiative a couple of years ago that allow low-level third strikers, low-level crimes not to count as third strikes anymore. But whatever the federal government does won't directly impact those. In fact, the states right now seem to be taking the lead. Some conservative states are rolling back their imprisonment policies, Texas and Arkansas, to save money. California is under court order to do so. But I guess just one other element that I'd like to enter into this. Attorney General Holder was very critical of mandatory minimum sentences, saying they oftentimes generate unfairly long sentences, breed disrespect for the system, and so forth. And I guess my response to that is, if you really don't like mandatory minimums and think that they breed disrespect for the law, the logical response seems to be stop using them, period. Not for a few people who don't have connections with gangs in the view of the prosecutors. You probably don't need them for the big fish, and you don't want them for the smaller fry. And if some mid-level drug dealer gets 8 years instead of 20 because the judge thinks that that's the sentence they deserve, well, that's why we have judges. And if the administration really believes that mandatory minimum sentences are leading to over-incarceration, it can take a much more direct action than it's taking now.
Oh, we've got just a couple of emails I want to read before we end. Nick says, one of the main purposes of AG Holder's statements is to get the NSA out of the headlines. I'm not sure that would happen because the information just continues to be leaked. But he writes, Obama's NSA's policies are such an embarrassment that he has to come out as someone who's doing the, quote, liberal thing after he ignores the Constitution, especially the Fourth Amendment. The same with stop and frisk. It still goes on. And then a listener in Berkeley writes, the other thing about stop and frisk, whether official policy or common practice anywhere, is that it's just so unpredictable. A black person can be going anywhere and doing nothing wrong to be detained in a stop that could end up in beatings, tasings, or death. It must be emphasized, though, that it really doesn't matter how a black person is dressed or walks or what his educational level is. Does your guest know about one of the latest cases of police homicide where police shot at a young black male's car 117 times? You know, I just searched for this and I couldn't find it anywhere. Bob, have you heard about this, or Kristen?
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, the only thing I just found, Salon reported that on August 7th, Florida cops shot an unarmed black man in his driveway, fired 15 shots at an unarmed 60-year-old black man in his driveway. That's horrible. But I didn't find the one that you mentioned. So thank you for the email. Bob, if you agree with Tim Dickinson that this is only going to affect a few thousand prosecutions a year, How do you explain these headlines? Major shift in drug sentencing, new approach, confronting overcrowding.
I think philosophy does count for something. It is unusual and maybe unprecedented for the top law enforcement officer in the nation to criticize not just, you know, mandatory minimums, which have been a staple of the system for decades, but over-incarceration. If that really is the view of the Obama administration, then it could well have an important long-term effect on both incarceration levels and priorities. It's something that members of Congress can remind the administration of at budget time. It's something that might affect judges and others who are called on to implement it. And really shouldn't discount. I don't want anything I've said to imply that it's not important for him to make this policy statement. You know, that said, we want to trust and believe our policymakers, our elected and appointed officials, that they mean what they say. The instant reaction is not skepticism, but isn't this amazing to hear?
Mm.
And I'd like, the proof has got to be in the doing after all this time of grand policy changes that have proven to be somewhat less in practice. Mm.
And a lot of people are saying that this might be a step in the right direction for people who are obviously in favor of reforming drug laws. We've got about a minute left. Bob, what are you working on right now?
Heavens. What am I working on right now? I'm working on daily stories and waiting for shoes to drop from the Ninth Circuit. And I think I'm going to work on a piece on President Obama and his treatment of a journalist in Yemen.
Ah, okay, great. Oh, and also, I forgot to mention this, but the Chronicle just got rid of its paywall after 4 months.
Yes.
So we can now read the Chronicle again online for free.
For free for non-subscribers can look at SFGate, and all of our content will instantly go up on it. And I honestly don't know the inside story of that. Perhaps it will be told sometime, but at the moment, it certainly should be a convenience to the public.
Yes, it is. And just quickly, Kristen, what are you working on?
I'm actually working right now on an article about Molly. I'm sure you know it's a very popular club drug right now, but unfortunately what people are taking when they take Molly is never what it is, or what it used to be supposed to be, which was MDMA. At this point, no one really has any idea what they're taking, and it's very popular.
Well, that'll be interesting to read. Thank you so much. Kristen Gwynn is associate editor at Alternet, and Bob Gielko is a staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What is the most effective tactic for abortion rights supporters? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. A group of activists are currently traveling to battleground states with very few clinics. Their message is abortion on demand and without apology. But groups like Planned Parenthood steer clear of that language. The last few years have seen a record number of restrictions. So what is the best way to protect this constitutional right? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This week in This American Life, a sheriff in California has a problem. His deputies spend too much time busting small-scale pot farmers, so he devises a plan. He'll let the farmers grow their pot as long as they register with the sheriff. Pretty good, right? Bust the big guys instead? So what did his deputies think?
The sheriff is off his rocker.
Stories of people who are just trying to help this week.
This American Life, Sunday at 1 here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, local public radio, online at kalw.org. Up next at 11 o'clock, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC, followed at noon by Tavis Smiley. Stay tuned.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. It's 7 p.m. in Egypt, where the curfew has just come into effect. Today was called a day of anger, and we now know that more than 50 people have been killed across Egypt as fresh clashes erupted between protesters and security forces. This violence comes 2 days after the military cleared protest camps in support of ousted Islamist President Morsi. There are makeshift morgues across Cairo dealing with the 638 people who died that day. This hour on World Have Your Say, we're going to speak to people who are trying to understand what these events mean for the future of their country. You can tweet us. Use the hashtag WHYS.